that?
Yes.
That's what they told her.
Call the House Committee on Judiciary to order.
That's the guy right there.
May 6th. Chair Barker had to go home, so you ended up with me. Like to have the reps come up, get Gagos. Reardon's not here, and Fagan, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3509.
Open up a public hearing on House Bill 3509.
House Bill 3509 allows local county officials to place regulations on where treatment facilities for sex offenders can be located. It declares an emergency would be effective upon passage.
Vice Chair Krieger, Vice Chair Garrett, thanks so much for having us here today. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson. I'm the state representative from House District 47, which is the part of Portland east of I-205. So the bill before you, House Bill 3509, really came up recently as an issue in my district. So I want to thank you for having a public hearing on this so late in the session. This came up because of a counseling clinic for sexual offenders that opened in the district called Whole Systems. And this was a facility that had previously been in the Selwood area. And because of public outrage, I would say, of having the facility in the neighborhood so close to some schools and really a lot of community activism around getting the facility out of there, it was pushed out of that area. It was in downtown area for a little bit, and then it moved into a building, Plaza 125, which is in my house district. When this came up, most of the people who found out about it because of a newspaper article in the Oregonian, and that's actually how I found out about it, too. The owner of this facility, Jonine Mano, tried to do some things to do outreach into the community, notifying people that she was there, but that process didn't work very well, and a lot of people felt a little blindsided by the opening of this. So in doing research and kind of responding to the emails and calls I was getting from my constituents, I saw that there wasn't any way for anybody to have boundaries on where these facilities could be located. There were no guidance for these business owners looking to place these facilities, and there was no guidelines around what kind of notifications to the community had to go through. So there was really a vacuum there. And what happened in this situation is that, again, there was a lot of public outrage about this facility. There are people who felt like they had no say in learning about this facility, no say in responding to the fact that this business was moving there. And we're, again, looking at a similar situation where people are going to be picketing, going to be protesting the placement of this clinic in the facility, which I don't think is good for the clinic, for the counseling center, which is trying to provide a really necessary service. And it's not good for the community in feeling that they didn't have a voice in the matter. So I drafted this bill as a way of starting a discussion around what is a better way to go through this process? What is a better way to site these facilities in our community in a way that serves the needs of the groups that are receiving the treatment so that they can receive this treatment as part of their daily lives, as part of community corrections, as part of learning how to act in society and get treatment, but also respecting the needs of the community there. So this is the first attempt at it, and I think it's done a really good job in starting a conversation within the community with different groups, for instance, the Partnership for Safety and Justice, the Alliance of Children's Programs. This has brought up a good conversation on kind of what hasn't worked in the past, where's the potentials to work into the future. And so I looked at this as a starting point to continue those conversations. This is really what it's done.
Okay, let's go next.
I'll go. Vice Chair Krieger and committee members, thank you for this opportunity to present to you this morning on this issue. And I want to thank Representative Vega Peterson for initiating this bill that we were able to join in with her on. I think that, I'm sorry, my name is Joe Gallegos. I am the with District 30, which is Hillsborough, North Plains, some parts of unincorporated Alloa and Washington County. I was actually contacted, I think it was last December or so, with a very similar incident and placement of a program, an intervention program for sex offenders. A class had been scheduled and was being held at Sunrise Church, which is also in my district. Sunrise is probably referred to as one of those mega churches, very large church, provides a lot of services, among which is a class, intervention for sex offenders. They literally bring them in from various parts of the city and from Portland, from other areas. They come in on the MACs and they attend these classes. And they've been doing that. I don't remember exactly when they began at the church, but they've been doing it for a while. And a parent group had tried to get them to move that class, as the church is literally 500 yards from an elementary school. And so that the parents obviously were very concerned about that and had really tried to talk to the pastor about getting the class moved. I first became aware of this situation from a newspaper article where the pastor had actually talked about his willingness to move the class. But it just never happened. And so as I said, I was contacted, I think, around December by the parent group and asked if I could intervene, if there's anything we could do to get the church to follow through on moving that class. And there really isn't any recourse for the parent group. So this is a great opportunity then to have attention drawn to this issue. I will say that I also got input from a lot of the community service entities within my district who all really support the church in the sense that it provides great services. But again, people recognize the concern about the school being so close. So this bill actually is a great little bill. It would provide a remedy for that, providing some more local control at the county level. And that way, I think it would provide a remedy and help the families. So I think that's pretty much my testimony. I think we'll...
For the record, Shamia Fagan, the state rep for House District 51. Again, I want to also thank my colleague, Jessica Vega-Peterson, for her leadership on this issue. I was equally concerned when I read the Oregonian article about the facility being moved from Selwood to East Portland. And again, obviously, these treatment facilities have to go somewhere, and we recognize that. But having the ability to go through notice procedures or at least allow a community such as East Portland or others to feel like they at least have a voice or some ability to, you know, protect their families and their kids, and then these sort of facilities or others like them are not just always going to end up in their neighborhood. So I just want to make a technical point about this bill. This is not a one-size-fits-all. This is a bill that merely gives authority to local jurisdictions. So this is not us here proposing a statewide system by which we decide where these facilities go at the state level. This is a bill that gives cities and counties the authority because, as Rep. Vega-Peterson and I became aware from the Oregonian article, is that there is not actually such authority in cities and counties now. So even if a city or a county wanted to protect folks in their jurisdiction, they would not be able to do so because there was not kind of an authorizing statute. So this is a bill that gives them that power. So I just want to make, you know, a point about that, that it's not a one-size-fits-all state solution, because we certainly recognize that different cities and different counties might have a different approach to this, but it does put the onus on those who are in the local level to be responsive to their communities to create rules and regulations around notice and around where these facilities can be located. Thanks.
And I just wanted to, one of the things that the only statute that we could find was ORS 169.690, which is around post-incarceration facilities, which are residential centers. That's really the only state statute that we have right now, and that has to do with notification and a community group being formed to help with the siting of those facilities. So what we're talking about here is not those residential facilities, but more of the kind of appointment-based counseling centers.
And good afternoon. I'm Jeff Reardon, Representative, District 48, right adjoining these folks. And thank you for having us here. I want you to stop and think for a minute. If you have neighborhood associations in your area, and I'm sure many of you do, imagine walking into a room full of the neighborhood association and chairs right after there was a public meeting regarding this center. And imagine that the people, our neighborhood chairs, perhaps some of yours, were there, and yet none of the people that should have been addressing these issues showed up. None of the county authorities or city authorities, nobody showed up. Nobody took it seriously. So that's what I listened to for about an hour and a half last week when I was at our neighborhood chairs. There are eight chairs were there, very active members all over East Portland. And to say they were lit up was kind of an understatement. But they're very concerned. They were concerned. They were vocal. But they were also realizing, yes, people need to have good transportation so they can get to and from the centers. We need to be able to provide this treatment, not a problem, but please not adjacent to multifamily housing, not adjacent to the schools. And please, if we're going to do this, notify us. Let us have some input to this. So that's, I thought they were really, excited as they were, very reasonable about it, but really knowing that we need some input, we need to have the opportunity to protect our neighborhoods. And so I'm just here, like I said, to support Representative Vega Peterson, and hope that you will as well. Thank you.
Committee members have any questions? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any of you can answer this question. I've got a couple questions, Mr. Chair. First one I have is I'm looking at the bill itself, and under Section 1, Subsection 2, and then you have A through E. You know, I'm thinking to myself, it's relatively a short list of considerations. And I understand the idea about wanting to provide a tool to assist city and county governments on this. How are you going to measure that?
How are we going to measure whether or not they follow those guidelines?
Yes.
I mean, so the language in the bill, again, it's not meant to be, didactic as far as what people have to do. I mean, that's why we chose the word shall. So these are suggestions on things that can be considered, but it gives local jurisdictions the flexibility to really consider things that may make sense for them. As far as checking it goes, I mean, I think that will have to do with kind of the success of placements of these counseling centers going forward. Do we run into a situation like this again where people do feel blindsided? Hopefully not. I mean, hopefully that's going to go.
Can you follow up then? Thank you. The Representative Reardon, you kind of touched on it a little bit, for the transportation piece of it as well as what's available. But then also, I mean, I get your concern about the safety and the protective efforts too as well. How does the Fair Housing Act play into this?
I do not know.
Let me follow up on that. That was one of the things that we really had to look at very hard for the placement and the issues with the Psychiatric Security Review Board, placements of homes and everything. So I'm just trying to kind of follow up here, PSRB. I mean, they're two different things, but yet where you're wanting to go with this.
Right. As far as these are not homes.
Right.
These are classes, are intervention, they're counseling sessions, and clients are transported into these classes. So it isn't a residential facility or anything like that.
Right. Vice Chair Krieger, Representative Olson, I don't believe that statute would touch this at all because these are not any kind of residential or living facility. There's no housing involved here. These are a commercial treatment facility.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So do you have any statistics on how often someone who is in one of these treatment facilities reoffends in the neighborhood? If you have any information about that, that would be helpful.
I believe that one of my constituents actually does have some of that data, and I believe it is a 12% recidivism 12% reoffending statistic. But she could speak to that more directly, I think.
Thank you.
Do any of you know if this has been addressed by some other state in any way? Have you looked at any other statutes anywhere?
Yeah, we my staff did some research into that, and we looked at, and it looks like in, I believe West Virginia has something on it, and I can get that information to you. There's very few states that actually have, and what that state did was they actually had in statute the guidelines, so it was more restrictive than what we're intending to do with this bill. But I can get you that information.
Thank you, Vice Chair Krieger. Do any of you know if the state runs any of these facilities, or the county, or are any of them publicly run, or are most of them privately run, either private, for-profit, or nonprofit? Any sense?
So the ones that I've heard about are publicly run, but they are contracted with public agencies, with the county or with the state, for to do these services. Oh, I'm sorry, privately run. Yes, thank you.
If you had a pre-existing facility that's run by a county government, mm-hmm, within a certain distance of, what would happen then?
That's a very, Vice Chair Krieger, that's a very good question, and that's something that, again, so I think it will be, I mean, again, it'll be up to the local jurisdiction. It's not mandating anything that needs to happen with those. But it's also why I'm opening to looking at, does this bill, should we include language about notification and maybe making that, you know, something that happens with people who are already, or facilities that are already located down there.
Are you going to try to bring this idea forward, you believe, in February to get it actually passed?
You know what, I think that it would be a good chance over the interim to continue the conversations, yeah, that we've been having with the stakeholders to see what's going to be the best solution and what exactly that would look like in February. I can't tell you right this second.
Any further questions? Thank you.
All right, thank you
very much. These are Janet Arends and Dee Hilton.
Thank you. Hi, good afternoon. I didn't get the names. What were the names?
Of what?
Of the folks that we're supposed to address? Or is it the whole body?
Whole body's fine.
Okay, I don't have anything prepared, but I'm a mother.
State your name, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Dee Hinton, and I'm a resident in Washington County, specifically Hillsborough, the city of Hillsborough. And I don't have anything prepared. I actually just left work to come down. But I'm a mother of three children. And I worked through the city of Hillsborough through a mediated process for a program that was running in the city that was adjacent property lines to my children's school, where they were serving through a religious program anywhere from 60 to 80 sex offenders. And there wasn't any sort of statute or any sort of code or zoning laws within the state or within the city that could address this problem and address the risk. And it's a neighborhood school. There's actually two schools that are within a mile radius of each other in this particular community. And we were able to get some revisions in some of the times that they were serving. But the risk of these sex offenders is so great to the actual members of this community church that they actually have an isolated program, and they actually have them going through separate doors. And I have a, just on a personal note, I have a daughter with autism. She's a high-risk, vulnerable child, and we're just trying to speak out for the youth that can't speak for themselves.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Krieger and Vice Chair Garrett and rest of the committee members. My name is Shannon Jones, and I'm here to support House Bill 3509. I'm a teacher, a mother, and a survivor myself. I very much understand the need to support sex offenders seeking and getting counseling, therapy, and the support that they might need to allow them to reenter society. However, saying that, I don't believe that these facilities should be located in areas where children often congregate.
Many of these programs operate outside of regular school and business hours in order to accommodate the needs of the offenders and not necessarily the protection of our children and the innocent. As a teacher, I often see children playing from my classroom window after school hours, and they come to play on the equipment and socialize with their friends. To see them laughing and having fun makes me smile, right up until the point I realize that they are there alone. Without adult supervision, and their parents aren't anywhere to be seen. I've often gone out and said, "Where are your mom and dad?" And the response has been, "Working." There are many young children who come home to an empty house and spend several hours hanging out at our school because they believe it's a safe place. The reality is, for many of these young children, that's the case. On weekends, I go and see other children alone by themselves. These are the times that the church next door is operating their sex offender classes. And what Dee did not explain is that they bus and they take the MAX and others carpool them in. They drop them off at the church. And the church doesn't see that they go back to the facilities because most of these are individuals who are housed either in the city jail or the county jail or within residential programs in our area. The church walks those people to the boundaries of their property and say goodbye. They don't ensure that these individuals are taken back to their facilities or catch the MAX, or there's no follow through. You might ask, why am I worried about the kids on my playground? Well, less than 500 feet from our school, actually we share the fence line, the church is busing registered sex offenders into a service called Light My Way. The church did not inform the families of the service taking place or that there needed to be heightened awareness. Bridget Sexton, she's the Portland Police Sex Offender Coordinator, stated that Oregon isn't as tough on sex offenders as many other states. As a result, many are seeing an increase in numbers moving here from out of state. In addition, national data shows that Oregon, either first or second behind Delaware, for the number of registered sex offenders registered sex offenders residents per capita. I know people say that sex offenders are the smallest population of criminals that we have and that their rate of reoffending is only 12%. But with an increase in the numbers, there's an increase in risk. Furthermore, if we put an actual number to it, it means a little more. It means that for every 100 sex offenders, 12 will reoffend. Do you want to gamble on those 12 having easy access to the most vulnerable and the most innocent? As a 9-year-old child, I suffered that. I apologize. The scars on me physically healed quickly, but emotionally it's obviously still a battle. The trauma left me feeling unloved, scared, and lonely. In an instant, my life was irrevocably changed. I was not the one who made the choice to take my innocence away. It was that of my offender. I don't want to see another child go through the pain and the suffering that I did just because society thinks it's only 12% who reoffend. The 12% are a part of a larger group seeking assistance in the areas where children are most vulnerable. Please help Bill 3509 get to the next level so that other innocent person's life is not changed without their consent.
Good afternoon. My name is Janet Ahrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. We're a statewide nonprofit that takes care of other nonprofits who take care of children. We represent about $205 million in services and programs for children and families, and that's about 100,000 children each year. Our member programs include child welfare, juvenile justice, runaway and homeless, kids with mental health issues, disabilities, and prevention services as well. And some of the children that we take care of have been offended themselves, and some of those children become offenders. Our treatment programs address both the needs of those who have been victims as well as those who've been offenders. The bill pretty, if you take a look at the statutes that are cited in the bill, it's really looking, and at the circumstances that were have been raised today, they're really addressing the violent offenders and the predatory adult offenders. However, if you dig around underneath some of these statutes, you'll see that eventually you'll get to an adjudicated youth, and that's a concern for us. Their recidivism rates are very, very low. The younger the child, the more likely they are to have an even lower recidivism rate, as low as 0% in some of my programs. The reoffending rate actually, as time goes on, gets lower and lower for even the older youth. So we would like very much to be able to consider focus on the right kind of a target. But having said that, we're also concerned about communication, transparency, and community engagement. So if I could just take off my Alliance hat for a moment and tell you that I've been on the board for my neighborhood association for 10 years. I was appointed by the mayor and the city of Portland to be part of a residential siting task force, and we spent 2 years in a small windowless room hashing out some of the many issues that both addressed the questions that the committee asked today as well as addressed the concerns that were raised by these ladies here and by our other legislative colleagues. There are actually, if you go on the I put in here that City of Portland has a website on their Portland Online that you can go to for the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, and there's quite a number of opportunities for people, for neighbors to find out what siting guidelines are, what strategies there are, what questions they can ask, what information they have a right to, as well as understanding what some of the protections may be, particularly for juveniles and other special needs populations. The people that are affected by special needs populations are not just sex offenders. There's lots of other folks who have issues that require treatment and support. There's for example, one of the documents that's on that line is this 28-page booklet, which if you look at the small print in here, you might see some of my fingerprints in some of this work. Although it was done over 10 years ago, it's got very, very good information that's transferable from residential to the kinds of outpatient and classes and courses and circumstances that are addressed here. So I am very supportive of the legislators who have brought very real concerns from their neighbors and their constituents here to the Capitol. But I'm also very supportive of Representative Vega Peterson's desire to see there be some conversation, because that conversation is the first part of the communication. It's going to get neighbors, the people, the information they need about the people who are in their community, about public safety issues, and they may be surprised at what is actually being done to provide protections. And I think that communication is the starting point for a better understanding of who we have in our community, meeting their needs, and making a commitment to short-term and long-term public safety. Thank you.
Other members? In your, just give me an idea. There's nothing in the bill, because they're going to leave that to the county or city on an ordinance. What type of distance in your mind would be adequate?
I think, if I may, Chair Krieger, it's not distance. I think the safety issues are greater than just distance.
How would you measure?
Well, I think one of the ways that you would measure public safety would be through saturation. One of the issues that we find triggers so many communities is when they are inundated with so many social services that they don't know and they don't have any control any longer over who's in their neighborhood or what their needs are, how they're being met, what the public safety issues are, how they're being met. So I think for one of the pieces that I came away from after 2 years working on this project was really that the city of Portland in particular, and this would be true of many other communities in Oregon, needs a bigger vision, not just the individual moment or the individual themselves who may be in their neighborhood, but an understanding, and so many people here have been terrific about recognizing the treatment needs of people, our responsibility to make that treatment available, to make access available, but also to do that in a fair and responsible way so that all the communities are sharing in that responsibility for their citizens.
Okay, it might be a good idea to spend some time with Representative Peterson so the two of you can get together a little bit on it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all, as that was said earlier. And we've got plenty of time to get it right before we get to February of next year. Representative Williamson.
Janet, in your work on residential facility placing, did you come across any jurisdictions that made it so prohibitive that there were no resident, there was an inability to site a residential treatment facility in that jurisdiction?
There, thank you, Chair Krieger and Representative Williamson. Yes, there have been circumstances where the siting guidelines were so restricted, the distance restricted, that they ended up in the middle of the Columbia River, which I'm sure would satisfy some folks. But we have a responsibility to keep them on dry land. Yes, it makes it very, very difficult. The other challenge with the programs and providers I represent is that they have many services in those buildings. They're not just providing a sex offender treatment program. So now you're taking away access and opportunity for children with many, many kinds of issues that that may lose the opportunity to be able to access those services.
Okay. Anybody else have anything? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have Thomas Madison and Marlene Larson, please.
Does it matter who goes first?
Nope, either one.
Okay, great. I have a presentation for you today. It's a fairly short presentation, only 12 slides, and a lot of the background for...
State your name first, please.
Oh, sorry about that. Tom Madison. I'm a registrant on the Sex Offender Registry. I live in Gresham, Oregon. Glad to be here today. Thank you very much. The reason that I'm here today is that I too, read that article in the Oregonia newspaper going back in the November timeframe, and I was pretty amazed that after all these years of my efforts and others like me trying to educate the public regarding sex offenders on the registry, one theme comes through over and over again, and that is stranger danger, stranger danger, stranger danger, and we can't seem to get off that record. So my presentation today, I'm going to skip through quite a few of the slides that I had prepared because I did want to talk about and remind all of us that the whole thing, at least recently, started in Selwood. There was a meeting there of very, very angry citizens who play along with this stranger danger idea. I went to that meeting that night and I wanted to bring facts to the floor. I mean, facts beyond just the anecdotal stories about somebody's past and somebody's your worries about the community and so forth. So I did go to that meeting. I was handed my hat, told to leave. They didn't want to hear facts. They wanted to have their drive the enemy out of the Selwood neighborhood party that night, and they had that party, certainly. They moved to southeast Portland, upper southeast Portland neighborhood. That's where they are now. That's where this controversy is right now. And again, the newspaper reports more neighbors, more concerns about stranger sex offenders going to a treatment provider in that area. And I was pretty amazed because here we go again. So I went to that meeting. They had one meeting, and it was a much more controlled crowd. Much more willing to listen, at least. They're more organized, and I made my presentation that night, just a 2 or 3 minute presentation. But again, I think the wheels are still moving forward to continue worrying about the people that attend sex offender treatment providers. And so I did a little research, and these are just a smattering of other representative locations of providers in the Portland area. There's one other in Portland, Southwest Portland. A couple of others in Washington County. And what I found was, looking and using a Google map and drilling down on these locations, I was trying to determine where the schools might be, where the bus stops might be, and all the rest of the infrastructure that we worry about with regard to kids. And it looked pretty much the same as what I saw both in Selwood, in the Selwood location for that treatment provider, and also their new location in Southeast Portland. So I can't find any difference, and that was rather interesting that there was seemingly no difference. So I thought today's presentation should focus on the kinds of facts that I keep bringing up to all the groups that I go to talk to. And this first one, there's only two data slides, and this is the first big one, and that big chart you see in front of you tells you that, and this comes from a meta-study of about 50 or so combined sub-studies, that shows us that the vast number of sex crimes are committed by first-time offenders, not people on the registry, obviously, first-time offenders. So where do those offenders come from? And this chart, the second of the charts I told you about, who are these offenders? And those three, is that out of focus for you?
Yeah.
It looks like it might be a little out of focus. But these three pie charts are really broken down from left to right in terms of age of the victim. The first one is 6 and under. The next middle one is victims ages 7 through to 11 years old. And the third one, 12 to 17. But the important part about understanding who are the offenders, and look at the color coding. That's a little bit hard to see. There's a dark red or brown and a light red, but those two combined represent where these offenders are coming from and who they are. And that is, as it says there on the indicator, family members and acquaintances. And notice that little tiny gray sliver of a portion of each of these charts, depending on the age range of the victim that you're talking about, and you see that it's labeled stranger. Notice that it doesn't say registered sex offender or registered sex offender in treatment, just stranger. That previous slide, I'm going to go back to that previous slide a minute. That sliver there, that blue sliver, is the number of, is a percentage of sex offenders who do commit new crimes. That's a 6% figure. That compares to some of the other figures you've heard in today's presentations. So if you want to understand of that gray sliver, how many are registered sex offender and stranger at the same time, it's 6% of whatever number those percentages are giving us. So in other words, the number of sex offenders attending treatment or on the registry, generally speaking, and who are strangers and find stranger victims to them, stranger child victims, is an infinitesimal number. The vast majority, I mean, look at that pie chart. The vast majority are family and friends and acquaintances who commit these crimes. And guess what? Well, where do families live? Well, they live in neighborhoods. They live in neighborhoods just like yours and mine and all the rest of those in this room, probably. And so it seems very very common sense to me that these treatment providers locate in the same communities where the sex offenders come from, these first-time sex offenders. And that's primarily who is making up the numbers of people attending sex offender treatment. So we had recently in the last 8 months a single case of a provider in Selwood having to move to another part of Portland. I put a bit of a kind of a campfire up there representing this fire, this controversy, this political and social controversy. But imagine handing this to the counties, where the counties all over the state, 36 counties, there's a brush fire statewide. Imagine counties with their politics and their concerned citizens giving testimony like I am now, except it's at a county level, and now we've got all kinds of crazy quilt outcomes for where those treatment providers are located. At the very edge of town? Maybe we push them to the very edge of our county up against the next county. That way the next county can kind of worry about it. Imagine that. The solution has to be that this problem, in this next session, I guess, when we tackle this problem, has to be that we have got to have this at a state level. It's got to be a mission where the state government, the legislature here, mandates the rules from this body and no other. So my recommendations today are to reject HB 3509 for all the reasons I've given you so far. Secondly, a new bill needs to come up, as I said a minute ago, that licenses where sex offender treatment providers can be located, and quite frankly, they need to be in the neighborhoods for all the safety reasons I've mentioned before, not the scary stranger danger reasons that you may have heard about before. And lastly, and this is really needed, another legislative bill that mainly aims at educating the public at large about the truth about registered sex offenders and the kinds of good neighbors that we really are and the law-abiding citizens that we are in this state. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, could I ask
yes.
a question? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Madison. Could you please send us the statistics that you gave us? It was very difficult for me to see. And also the materials that you based those statistics on, the studies that you based those on.
Absolutely.
That would be really helpful. In fact,
there's a reference there, but I'll be glad to mail that to you.
I can't read that. That would be great. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On that note, the preceding slide to this one, the 94, I didn't see a source at the bottom. Would you mind emailing, just including?
Absolutely. My apology. It was supposed to be on there, but I didn't get it there.
Okay.
Is that it?
Yeah. Oh.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that, my name is Marlene Larson Madison, and as we heard from the other people here, most people in this room that even heard about any of these treatment providers heard about it from the newspaper. And the newspaper uses terms like predator, pervert, and pedophile when they talk about this. They stir up fear and anger, and you would feel that way. And another thing is when you use the term sex offender, it's in the present tense. It shouldn't be used in the present tense. These people they've already committed a crime. They've paid their debt. And these ages of these people, these are not monsters. These are people you see every day in your community. Some of them are as young as 19. There was a guy that we just met the other day that was 19 years old. He's been on the registry in Oregon since he was 15. Because he had sex with a girlfriend that was 13. Now, there's something wrong with that. We have to have some compassion for these people. How much hope? What can you do for them? And as far as having what happened to you when you're a child, everybody has gone through something in life that is tragic, but we must have the empathy and compassion for others instead of worrying about what happened to so-and-so 30 years ago. We have to start to make serious laws, and it's silly to worry about getting a whole slew of people moving into Oregon that are sex offenders. They're ordinary people. All they want is have a job, a family to raise, and to get on with their lives. Most of them never commit a crime. And I will say there's two crimes that have been committed that we've heard in the news that are I directly think they're related to the way the laws are now, and if you really want to protect children, you'd really take this seriously. And it's one of them is the DeGar gal down in California. The reason that she was never found was because here is a guy, and you can't blame the officers that go to check on these sex offenders. When you've got a backlog of over 500 or so sex offenders you're trying to look at, these guys run in and out. They all mash together. They can't tell who they're looking for and who's good and who's bad, who's dangerous. They don't even hardly have time to read the reports on these people, except when they come to testify. I think the registry is really a false thing. I think the only thing that should be a registry is if somebody has had more than one offense. If they have had more repeated offenses, kidnapped someone, injured a child, that's important then. And not on the registry for public, but of course the sheriff's department should know that. And I just hope that you guys use more data than the newspaper and public opinion to base your opinions on, because this is a long-term effect when you make a decision, and it affects thousands and thousands of people. So thank you. And I'll leave these cards up here. This is also a website and a site that we started that has a lot of information in it.
Any questions, committee? Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I would only say that there may be a one-time happening, but if it's the wrong type of a crime for a young child or woman, it can be something that you live with all your life. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3509 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 482A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 482A adds saliva to the list of fluids that are illegal to propel at public safety officers when they come into contact with those public safety officers. Declares an emergency effective upon passage.
Have Brian Demlashmit, Gail Meyer, and Mary Botkin, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it's good to see you with gavel today. My name is Brian DeLeishman. I represent the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Oregon State Police Officers Association. Let me start by saying, giving you a little history on how this whole issue has evolved. Several sessions ago, the Oregon legislature established assault by bodily fluids that currently covers corrections officers, as well as others in correctional settings. A couple sessions after that, then that also was expanded to police officers as well. But the one exception that was not covered when they made the expansion was saliva. So what we're talking about here is, we call it sliming, bodily fluids, assault by bodily fluids. It's blood, urine, feces, and saliva. And in many correctional settings, that was the only way that folks behind bars were able to act up. They were able to try and get back at a correctional officer. We then found, as we went along, that these kinds of incidents were also happening on our streets to police officers as well. So we came back, like I said, I expanded it to include police officers. The bill is not simply about spitting on a police officer. It's about the health and safety of public safety officers. Let me give you a couple of examples. When an officer is exposed to one of these sliming, including saliva, they must undergo tests to see if there was exposure, first from somebody who had the disease and is trying to transmit it. Secondly, the officer must, until they're given the all is fine and the person doesn't have the disease, must refrain from a number of things like kissing your spouse and kids, unprotected sex with the spouse, any other behavior that may transmit the disease to others in the family and the public. What we're talking about here is transmission of HIV, AIDS, hepatitis, tuberculosis, and others. The officer then, until they're given the all clear, what happens is a lot of times the perpetrator is compelled to give a test to find out whether or not they are in fact have an exposure. And until that test comes back, the officers are actually put on a prophylactic medication. It's almost like a chemotherapy. It makes you very ill during that period of time. When the test finally comes back, it may be negative at the time, but in a lot of cases, you have to go back and test for a period of time, 6 months and a year. So in some cases, the actual officer has to then go on and have tests for a period of time. And of course, the things that I mentioned above, you have to refrain from as possibly exposing others in your family. Let me share with you a couple of communications that I've had historically, and I've got a whole file on this, but I'll just give me a couple of them. This one is an officer, I believe, out of Portland. He writes, about 20 months ago, he assisted on a disturbance call involving an unknown adult male screaming and smashing through a fence. Several other officers had arrived in the area and began looking for the individual. When he was located in the backyard, screaming and swinging a board from a fence that he had torn down, he was bleeding from the hands and face and mouth. He was high in meth and was eventually handcuffed and hobbled. When we were searching him prior to placing him in the patrol car, he rolled over and spit blood in the officer's face, the officer that's talking about here. The officer goes on and talks about the psychological impact that this has on him and his family, the fact that his wife actually pulls away from him once she found out. This officer had been involved in an officer-involved shooting, and he said, as far as the trauma that it created and turmoil in his family, this was more devastating to his family than an officer-involved shooting because it impacted the entire family, not just the officer themselves. The next one that I would read is an officer from Gresham talks about drunk driving arrest, transporting the person to the cell. The person acted aggressively toward him, actually trying to get into a physical confrontation. The male continued to taunt nonstop and came to the point where the officer was ignoring him and while they were doing their paperwork, and the individual then spit in his face. The cases that I talk about here, these people actually, it's not spit at an officer, it's spit on an officer, and when they do this, they actually try and spit into the mouth or into the eyes, where it's the most effective as far as potentially impacting somebody and infecting them. These folks have two intents. If they know that they're not infected, And they spit, and a lot of times what they'll say is, ha, 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 I've got HIV, I've got AIDS or whatever, and now you're going to get it. That's a kind of a psychological assault. In the cases where they actually do have the disease, they are actually trying to infect somebody. With that, I'll leave it. There's one additional case, but I'm going on, and I know you've been here for a while. Obviously, this bill is very important to our police officers. It passed the Senate 29-0, and we would appreciate your support in passing the bill out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mary Botkin with Abstinent Council 75. And we represent roughly 3,000 folks who work in the Oregon prison system. And this is an ongoing problem. You know, as Brian so eloquently put it, we have passed legislation in the past to protect officers from, you know, the sliming and the cocktails that we all have heard about over the years. And I think Brian put it very well, that this is, in many cases, intentional harassment and psychological as well as physical harassment of the officers who are working, officers and staff who are working inside the system. We have, and he failed to mention, we also included a couple of sessions ago volunteer exposure because, you know, at times our volunteers who come in to work in the prisons are also exposed. And so this is, you know, these are all issues that really need to be dealt with. And I have to tell you that in my naivete, I actually thought saliva was covered and have since learned that it is not. And so this is, you know, I see this as a corrective piece of legislation to make sure that all bodily fluids are covered. And this is, you know, this is a health issue. This is a health issue for the officers and staff who work in the prison system. And it is a critical issue for them. Long-term health impacts are severe, and this will help.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. So you're representing corrections officers, and my reading of the statute is that they are classified as staff members. Not you, DeLashman, but Mary. And
I think I can clarify where you're headed with a question.
Please do.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, just a slight correction on the testimony from Ms. Botkin. Actually, this only changes and adds saliva to the assault on a police officer. Saliva is already included as far as correctional officers. It's two different sections of the statute. So saliva has always historically been covered on correctional officers, staff, and volunteers. This just adds the one piece that was left out a number of sessions ago when we expanded it to police officers themselves, which added saliva, which was already covered on correctional officers.
And we would support that as well.
Okay. We probably did at some point. Cause it's the law. Okay, thanks.
Brian and Mary, do either of you know if there, when the law was passed several sessions ago or expanded, was there a reduction in these types of assaults in these situations? I'm wondering if there's a fiscal on this or if the impact of passing this, that this legislation will actually be that there are less assaults charged.
Chair Krieger, Representative Williamson, actually, I believe there was a substantial reduction, especially in the correctional setting, where you have a combined audience. What we were finding was with mandatory minimums, Measure 11 crimes, these folks had, there was no downside because they didn't get earned time. They didn't get good time off. So they could act up as much as they wanted. When it was expanded to correctional officers, it actually included an additional sentence. So they actually then got what we would call bad time, additional time. We had a number of cases around the state in correctional facilities where it seemed to cut it off just like that. We have obviously a slightly different situation when you're on the street with police officers, but keep in mind you're actually in many cases dealing with the same type of subject. You know, when you're doing an arrest of somebody who's on meth, that's swinging a board and intentionally trying to infect somebody, chances are they've been in and out of jails and correctional settings many times. They're aware of this. So obviously, we think it was a reduction in the correctional setting. We think the sliming, excluding saliva up to this point, has had a positive impact on the streets, and we hope that the saliva would have the same impact.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I recall in 2009 when this bill came forward, I also recall that my friend, former Representative Jefferson Smith, somehow was obsessed with this and the saliva issue in particular. And as I recall, and this is going from memory, a memory that I thought was buried and would never come back, and unfortunately I was incorrect. I think he was concerned about war protests, if I'm not mistaken. Am I on the right track? Were any of you guys on that work group with Representative Smith? Can you talk about, I mean, it was not an accident. It was a conscious policy choice, the law that was enacted in 09. We're now changing it. It seems like kind of an end round around Jefferson.
Representative Krieger, Representative Barton, I did serve on that group, and there actually was a number of participants, the work of Jefferson Smith, Representative Jefferson Smith, was valued at the time. I think what we came down to was a disagreement, primarily based upon the time that we had left in the session, of trying to get the expansion to police officers through, when the only thing that was hanging it up was a discussion about saliva, and whether it was intentional or accidental, whether you get so worked up, you have a face-to-face with a police officer, you get so worked up, a little spittle comes out of your mouth, so forth. Those are the kinds of things that we talked about, and we finally just threw up our hands and said, let's cover police officers with the exclusion of saliva on all the other bodily fluids, and let's look at this in the future. This issue came up as a result of a case in Lane County, and it was Senator Prozanski, who actually was the prosecutor in the case. So we didn't bring the bill up. Mm-hmm. He actually brought the bill up based upon a case that he was surprised that saliva was not covered, and he thought it was so outrageous that in the case that he had that saliva was not covered, that he decided to bring the bill forward. And, of course, we piled on. So we'd love to have the bill.
Gail.
Thank you. Vice Chairs Krieger and Garrett, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Yes, Representative Barton, it is deja vu all over again. This was active in 2009. There was a work group. There was no qualm with adding what is now subsection B, so making it unlawful for someone to knowingly propel blood, urine, semen, or feces at a public safety officer out in the field. But as a result of the work group, not that there was consensus, I think the end result was to exempt saliva from that. And it did come down to the question of, do we really want to felonize spitting at someone? That was the issue, really. So, I there was a big distinction made between this conduct occurring in a correctional facility versus out there in the field. It used to be pretty rampant in a correctional facility. And what you had people there serving mandatory minimum sentences. There was group activity, a lot of copycat crime. There was entertainment. There was boredom. But it was rampant. And so there was legislation, I believe it was 1999. That felonized it, and it did have an immediate deterrent effect because in the institution you have group understanding and knowledge of what the penalties are, and there was also a mandatory incarceration in a state correctional facility, so you're going to get consecutive time. And it did have an immediate effect. The question is, will this have a deterrent effect out there in the field? And this question came up in 2009. These are situational and isolated instances usually. And I would question the deterrent value because there's a huge mental illness overlay. The instances that even Mr. DeLashmit testified to were instances where someone was high on meth or intoxicated. And there's a huge mental illness overlay. There's people who just engage in this behavior not in their proper mind. We did, in 2009, look at other states. We had created a chart that's now old, so I can't pass it out, but it was saliva crimes by state. And but it looked at it. So some states make it a felony if the person is HIV positive or does have hepatitis B or C. The question is, and Mr. DeLashmit and I went through this a lot, how do you get there? How do you find that out? That's the difficult part. And some would say that it's a felony only if you're incarcerated, which is what we do currently. Some would make it a misdemeanor, your first offense, a felony, your second. I do point out that the debate, too, in 2009 was, really, if you spit at an officer's boot, is it a felony? And as this is written, and this amendment, if I recall correctly, came in at the last minute on the Senate side, I could be wrong about that. The amendment here now says that they must intentionally propel saliva at the officer and come into physical contact with the officer, but it doesn't mandate that the contact be in an area that would subject the officer to infection. So I don't know yet that this is still tight enough. I think it's a serious question for the committee. Is spitting something that should be a felony? And I note that there is often continual effort to felonize what currently is assault or harassment. We've got at least three other bills in the system right now that attempt to create C felonies out of simple assault, and this would be another instance. So we would urge caution.
So, Gail, it's not just felonizing it, it's requiring a term of incarceration in a state facility as well, right? Am I reading that correctly?
Co-Chairs Krieger and Garrett and Representative Williamson, as at first I was alarmed by that too, but it does say that when a person is convicted of subsection 1A, and 1A is limited to staff members in a correctional facility.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
It refers back to subsection 1A on line 9.
So it's just a C felony.
Yes. Committee members, anyone else have anything on it?
Do you have any questions?
Yeah, you have questions?
Right, no, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Are we having a work session today?
I was just going to say there's been some expression that maybe we should hold over and talk about a couple issues, so wait for our chair to get back, so we will close. Oh. Did you want to come up?
Yes, very briefly.
Boy, it better be.
Because we're running out of time. We only have 58 minutes left.
We're gonna get it I'll back that you kept this bill alive.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. We did chime in opposition to the bill on the Senate side and appreciate some of the narrowing amendments. I think we agree with OCDLA that they could be a bit more narrowed. The reason I'm popping up to chime in is because there's been some discussion about saliva transferring HIV or AIDS.
Yeah.
I did a little bit of research on the Senate side. It was anecdotal, and I'm not a doctor, but I think that with a little bit more time, I'd be happy to check in. I'm not sure that's true. So to the extent that that affects your decision about the bill, happy to follow up and get that answer.
Any questions for her? Okay, thank you. And we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 482A. Anything else for the committee? If not, we're adjourned.
Wow.